Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, March 29th. In a nod to Women's History Month, today we have a Hanaho show honoring notable women in our state's history. We start with highlighting the return of Queen Liliʻuokalani's portrait from an exhibit in Washington, D.C. We'll also hear about the role of Hawaii women in World War II from an author writing a new book about their experience. And former First Lady Jean Ariyoshi reflects on her campaign to plant a million trees. Plus, we'll take a closer look at the contribution women made to the National Park Service. We've got a women's history lesson for you, island style. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Women's History Month is coming to a close, so we have a Hanaho show for you, showcasing interviews with or about notable women in Hawaii's history. We start out with one of the most revered women in Hawaii's history, Queen Liliʻuokalani. Her portrait was transported from Iolani Palace to Washington, D.C. to be part of an exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery. It was entitled 1898, U.S. Imperial Visions and Revisions. It looked at the expansion policies of America following the Spanish-American War and drew close to a million people. HPR was there on opening day in April 2023, and for those in the room, it was a mix of pride and pain. In a private gathering before the official public opening, a contingent from Hawaii chanted the Queen's genealogy and sang Hawaii Pono'i. Throughout, tears flowed as the music haunted the halls of the Portrait Gallery. After nearly a year and a half in our nation's capital, the portrait returned home this month. We talked to State Archivist Adam Jansen about its return.
We were very fortunate in this partnership with the National Portrait Gallery. They desperately wanted the Cogswell portrait of Her Majesty Queen Liliʻuokalani to be the premier piece of the collection. It was put in a place of prominence. As you walk in the door, it was the thing that drew everybody's eye. So they really pulled out all the stops to be able to facilitate this loan. And that did include making sure that the canvas was cleaned and that the frame was restored. And to me, that was the really important takeaway. You know, if the people of Hawaii were going to be without her portrait for 10 months, there had to be something that they would get in return for her absence. And having that frame regilded and strengthened was really important to ensuring the long-term viability of that frame and also making sure that the portrait is presented in its finest light. So we're very, very proud of the work that was done. It has not looked this beautiful for many decades. And so I would encourage everyone, even if you've seen it before, please come back, see it again, really kind of for the first time with the frame completely gilded as it would have been when it was new back in 1891.
Well, I remember when we had a company come here to regild the King Kamehameha statue out there in front of the judiciary, and boy, did it look fabulous when they were done.
Absolutely. It's not just the fact that it was done. It was the fact that it was done by one of the finest frame conservators on the East Coast. The Gold Leaf Studio who did this work are absolutely top-notch individuals. So I had every faith that they were going to not just do it right, but do it justice. Because the owner of the studio actually used to live in Hawaii. For him, this was very personal. He still has a love and affinity for the Queen. And so for him to do this, it wasn't a job. It was a labor of love. And the work that he put into this absolutely shows that.
Oh, what a nice story. That's a nice connect. And so what can you tell us about, you know, how many people actually saw the exhibit of 1898?
According to the National Portrait Gallery, there were an estimated 962,000 attendees who came into the National Portrait Gallery during the time that this portrait was on display. Now, how many of those actually made it up to the gallery? They don't track that. But I am very proud of the fact that I was able to go back to DC on two separate occasions during the run and, you know, sneak up into the gallery to kind of watch other people experiencing this for the first time. And everybody came away moved. It was absolutely an incredible experience to watch other people viewing this portrait, because I mean, keep in mind, it's 10 feet tall. It's absolutely enormous in scope, larger than life. And the way they had it hung and lit, it was absolutely exquisitely beautiful. And so for folks who have never been to Hawaii, they got to experience what it is like to actually experience some of our history and see the royalty on display.
To me, after seeing that exhibit, the takeaway was to see the bird's eye view and how we were all connected and the stories about how changed these islands were after that point in time.
The National Portrait Gallery wanted to take a new look at the 1898 imperialist expansion in the United States, the whole Manifest Destiny push to get military bases strategically located in both the Atlantic and the Pacific. You know, this is a story that I don't recall ever being told through that lens of how it impacted the native populations and how they united to resist these occupations. To have, again, a wing of the federal government tell that in a very compelling, straightforward way is really a blessing for us, because in a lot of ways, they could get the story out that we here in the middle of the Pacific aren't able to, because they're reaching a much, much larger audience. You know, almost a million people came through the gallery in 10 months. You know, we don't have that many coming into the archives or the palace to be able to hear that story.
Yes. And then to be able to appreciate what the Filipinos went through and the folks in Cuba and, you know, here in Hawaii and in Guam. And so to me, that was pretty powerful. I know there are some who saw the exhibit who felt it didn't go far enough to tell Hawaii's story. And, you know, I understand that there's a group that is trying to build on this exhibit and go farther so that we can teach the young Filipinos who live here on the island, or the Chamorros, or the Puerto Ricans, about that history.
And that's important, because until we address these issues, we can never move forward as a society, as a group. And to see that Hawaii wasn't alone, you know, the Philippines weren't alone, Guam was not alone, that a lot of these cultures experienced the same turmoil and upset when the U.S. continued to expand is important, because they're not alone. You know, there is a common shared experience that they can help share and learn and hopefully grow with together.
Yeah, for me, it was the context, and I appreciated that exhibit for that reason. But gosh, so then for all of us here, we can go back to the palace and visit the Queen and just appreciate the facelift, I guess, if you will, and the fact that she's back home safely.
Absolutely. And then again, I would encourage everybody, even if you've been there, even if you've seen it, it's really worth coming back, because it is absolutely beautiful. The frame is fresh. The canvas is cleaned. It looks as good as the day it was painted back in 1891.
All right. Well, Adam Jansen, thank you so much. Appreciate your time today.
It's always a pleasure, Catherine. Thank you for having me on.
That was Adam Jansen, state archivist, who helped install the Queen's portrait back on the wall in the Blue Room at Iolani Palace. An honor guard of state sheriffs, including several female officers, along with members of the Royal Societies, were on hand earlier this month as the portrait arrived back in Honolulu. It was on loan in Washington, D.C. for close to a year and a half as part of an exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery. The Smithsonian restored the painting as part of the loan agreement. It's been more than a year since the state announced a campaign to plant 100 million trees by 2030. More than three decades ago, former First Lady Jean Ariyoshi took on the task of planting trees. Not long ago, we took time to talk with her to reflect on her A Million Trees for Aloha campaign, one of the many campaigns she took on during her 12 years of service. It was tied to the 100th anniversary of the arrival of Japanese plantation workers. We sat down with her in September 2022 in her Nu'uanu home to reflect on that monumental effort.
Well, that was the 100th anniversary of the first Japanese immigrant coming to Hawaii. And so everybody was doing their projects and, you know, in celebration. And George was governor at that time. And so I wanted to do something worthwhile, you know. And the idea of trees have always, you know, you can see my house surrounded by trees. And it was something that I thought would be a good idea. So at that time, C. Brewer was headed by Doc Byers. And I said, Doc, I said, would you be my co-chair if I did this, you know? And he said, and he was a perfect man for it. And so, because he was all in sync with what we were thinking about trees and the goodness of trees, and he planted a lot of trees too, you know, from his company. And so at first I really said, okay, everybody, when I got the committee together, I had a big committee to help me. And, you know, because we cannot do things alone. We do things with the help of others. You know, we're on the shoulders of so many people. So you can't get all of the credit. No, it's so many people were just involved in this project, and that was only why it was successful. And so I had to first, of course, ask my husband if DLNR would help me with the seedlings, you know, because I can't plant trees without the seedlings. So I told the committee, we're going to plant 5 million trees, but they were flabbergasted. They never thought I was going to do 5 million, maybe 500, or maybe 50, they thought. So finally, they got to me and they said, Joan Bixon at that time was my best friend. Joan said, Jean, you know, the boys are worried, so can we bring the number down? I said, oh, okay. Then I said, hey, 1 million, because at that time there were 1 million residents in Hawaii. So I said, let's plant 1 million trees for 1 million residents. You know, that made sense. And so that's how that project came about. But I could not have done it without all the four mayors helping me. And we had organizations helping statewide. And we had gone to places to plant trees, but for ceremonies. And we went with groups to plant, you know, once we would do that. But we also had, whenever there was a big circus or any time when you had a carnival or big gatherings, we were there. And we were passing out the little seedlings, little trees, which people, I made them sign an autograph thing with me that they would plant it and take care of it. And so they had this certificate. And that's how we went doing the whole project. And instead of 1 year, it lasted 2 years, but every month we added the trees and we'd hit 1 million, but we finally did. I remember we went to Diamond Head. One of my projects is I had the prisoners help me plant the trees. And they were, you know, the prisoners that were safe to be released type. And I was very thankful. So they came and helped me, and we planted trees in Diamond Head. And we had to put in a water system to sprinkle. You know, somebody had to water the trees. And unfortunately, just a few survived, they tell me, because people stole the water system. But some grew, very few maybe. And then I know along the Hilo Airport, all those trees are grown big. And on Kauai, we did a big planting along the big highway. But Mayor Kunimura at that time had people in charge of watering their trees. It was their tree, you know, that type of thing. I'm sure not all of them survived. We had cherry blossom trees shipped to us from Japan, and so we did plant those. Lots I sent to Wahiawa, which you will see.
Yes, I was just there during cherry blossom season because someone posted something on social media, Kalani Bakery, I think, and I thought, now's my opportunity to go see those cherry blossom trees. But, I did not know that. So that's a nice connection because you're from Wahiawa.
Right. Yeah, I'm a Waihoa girl, graduated from Lelehua.
so that's pretty neat. And then we're sitting here, and there's this lovely carving of, I think it's a Norfolk pine or a Cook pine?
Yeah, it's a beautiful vase-like. But it was just given to Governor last night at Washington Place from all the Pacific Islander leaders, and it was a group that he started way back with Ratu Mara, who was the Prime Minister of Fiji. They were the founders of this group because they are nations and they were never noticed and recognized at that time. And so that's why Ratu Mara and also George got together and they started this group. And so now the groups are still together. And now, you know, as you say, they've become very important because of our relations with, you know, other countries like China, etc.
Well, then I think then this was a seedling of an idea that Governor Ariyoshi had to make sure that these island nations receive the prominence that they deserve, a seat at the table to talk about what was happening in their region.
But you know, George tells me this story about how when he was in Washington, D.C. once, he saw these Pacific leaders, you know, just walking around. They were not invited to the White House or they had no place to go. I mean, you know, nobody was taking care of them. So that's why I think that idea sprang in his mind at that time. Hey, these are not only Pacific Islands. They are nations. You know, they're countries. And so I think that's what gave him that seed for that idea grew from that.
Right. And so now we are where we're at today, and they are stronger. They have more power.
They've become so important to the United States now.
Tiny nations growing strong under an idea, thanks to Governor Ariyoshi.
Yes.
That was former First Lady Jean Ariyoshi, who, along with Governor George Ariyoshi, remain active, particularly with veterans or Pacific region issues. We checked on the status of those trees that were planted at Diamond Head Crater, and Jean was right. Many did not survive, but there is said to be one that is thriving at the back of the crater. Across the Hawaiian Islands, more than 100 women took part in a top-secret program during World War II. It was called the Women's Air Raid Defense, or WARD. They were tasked with plotting radar reports and reporting suspicious activity up the chain of command. In 2018, we spoke to ACAM Napier, who wrote a book entitled Shuffleboard Pilots. Here's a clip from that conversation to refresh your memory on this little-known slice of history.
I was part of a small team of three people that worked on a book way back in about 1990, 1991, called Shuffleboard Pilots, History of the Women's Air Raid Defense in Hawaii from 41 to 45.
So explain the title.
Well, Shuffleboard Pilots was kind of the nickname for the WARDs, the Women's Air Raid Defense. So I don't know if you've seen like World War II movies where there's a big room with a table-sized map of an area, in this case, the Hawaiian Islands. And around that table are all these ladies in uniform with headsets, and they have these long sticks that they use to move little flags and little wooden ships and things that stand in for aircraft. So they're called shuffleboard pilots because they would be moving these little symbols around on this giant tabletop map, which sounds very simple, but what they were doing was a very essential thing.
Now a new historian has taken up the mantle of telling their story and expanded her search to all of Hawaii's underappreciated women at war. Sarah Louise Miller wrote an article for the British Journal for Military History about the parallels between the Women's Air Raid Defense and a similar program in England during World War II. She spoke to The Conversation's Maddie Bender earlier this month about why few today remember these women's heroic contributions.
I was on Oahu actually doing some research for my PhD, which was on women in the US Navy and the Royal Navy and the work that they did in naval intelligence in the Second World War. So I was in the University of Hawaii's War Depository Archive, and I didn't know what I was going to find. And I went in and there were these boxes, just literally a pile of boxes. And it's a bit overwhelming, but it's also, for a history researcher, it's something you want to see. It's really exciting. And I took the lids off, and as I start going through this stuff, you know, it's all rusty paper clips, and it's clear that it hasn't been taken out for quite a long time. And I found this amazing cache of information on the war. So there were transcribed interviews with these women who had been in this organisation, and it was just one of those gold dust moments where, as a researcher, you literally feel like, eureka, you know, I've found something amazing here.
Did you ask other historians, hey, have you heard of this? And did anyone know about it?
Yeah, no, I couldn't find much on it anywhere. So I found one book that had been produced in Hawaii by people that had known these women, which was a fantastic book, actually. Shuffleboard Pilots, it's called. But apart from that, couldn't find anything. And I had actually, for my MPhil, my master's degree, I'd written on something called the Dowding System in Britain, which was an integrated air defence system in the UK that we used throughout the Battle of Britain in 1940. And I was really surprised by the massive coincidence that this was, because I did my master's degree pretty much on that system. And then here's the WARD, and it's directly modelled on it. So they'd looked at this example in the UK where women had worked in radar and integrated air defence toward the defence of an island. And then Hawaii, 7,500 miles away, has looked at that and gone, that really worked. Let's try it. And then they do it. They put women in the same positions. And it was just an amazing coincidence, really.
So starting with how it was formed, essentially the men on duty were all fired and replaced by women. And that, especially for the 40s, seems like such a fascinating choice.
It is an odd one, isn't it? So you've got, obviously, on the 7th of December, the day of infamy, where the Japanese attack happens, and the radar equipment on Oahu was functioning fine. It picked it up. It was the system that the radar was part of that failed, ultimately. So in an integrated air defense system, you've got your radar equipment that picks up incoming aircraft. But what you need, why it's integrated, is because you've got people with expertise who can analyze what is that contact, where is it going, what kind of threat might it be, and alert the right people to put planes up and ships out to deal with it. That's the part that failed. If this system had been running 24/7 the way that it was in England, this might not have happened. So they very quickly establish the ward, and that decision to use women is kind of revolutionary. So you look at what's happened and you kind of think the last reaction you'd have there is to go, let's put a load of women around a map table and get them to be in charge of the integrated air defence of Hawaii. But that is what they do. And a lot of that is because the men are needed out on ships and in the jungles in the Pacific as the war becomes clear that it's going to be a war. They can't send women because under law at that time, we can't put women in combat positions. But what they can do is remain in bunkers and buildings and do this important work in the relative safety. It's not complete safety, obviously, in Hawaii, but they're sort of relatively safe. So it's a little bit more comfortable for us to let them do that. They are in this little world of their own, and it has to stay that way to keep it secret. And they're very good at that. So it's not ultimately expected of women to be any good at keeping secrets. You can see that if you look at World War II propaganda, kind of depicts women as massive gossips. But these ladies, ultimately, I think one of the reasons we don't know very much about it is because they were very good at keeping shtum. And they didn't talk about it even after the war.
Were these women that had any background in map making or interpreting, or were they trained up to do this?
They're at the time, so in the 1940s, in both the US and in the UK, a lot of women don't have a huge amount of experience in things like geography or maths or science or engineering or anything like that. So they've got a lot of experience in other subjects, and it's about kind of taking the skills that they have in their sort of domestic role and going, how can we use them toward the war effort? And that's ultimately what you get with the ward. So there is a hilarious quote in the British version of this system where the guy that's sort of responsible for developing radar technology says, well, women would be quite good at this work because they're good darners of socks. And what that means is ultimately they're quite good at sitting there for long periods of time and doing something that's actually quite boring. That's what he meant. Interestingly, they're put through the same psychological testing for this work as fighter pilots are, because it's recognized as being quite stressful. And obviously the kind of responsibility that's on their shoulders is huge.
Darners of socks. What a backhanded compliment.
Yeah, there's one too in DC where they say, oh, women are quite good at painting their nails. So that kind of attention to detail is useful in various types of war work.
This did seem to be the kind of job where anomalies were rare, but when they happened, they could be quite critical. Another moment of high tension that you write about is the Battle of Midway.
Midway is an interesting one because we instinctively look at that battle, and because it is before women are allowed to serve on ships at sea in active duty, then we think there are no women involved in Midway. It's not a woman's battle. But that's completely inaccurate. Once you know about the war, you have to basically reevaluate what you think you know about women and their involvement in the war effort in Hawaii. So what they do is when the attack happens on the 5th of March, the US military is involved in this major confrontation with the Imperial Japanese Navy. That keeps the ward very, very busy. So while they're not kind of there in the combat zone, what they are doing is talking American planes back onto the islands, helping them to land. They're usually damaged. The airfields on Oahu are blacked out because the blackout means the Japanese can't see to bomb. That's exactly what we did in Britain. Means planes have a more difficult time landing, though. So what the ward are doing is they are monitoring the battle. They're allowing the powers that be to see what's happening, but they're also helping American planes and airmen to get home and to land in the pitch black darkness. So they're literally talking these people down and making sure that when they land, they've got medical attention when they need it. It's effectively life-saving.
Were there other narratives or stories that you found in these transcripts of interviews or in your own research of exceptional women who served in the ward?
There are plenty. I think the ones that really stick out to me are women who carry on doing this work when they've suffered incredible loss. Kathleen Hamlin, she works very efficiently. Her husband's a prisoner of war following the sinking of his vessel, the USS Houston, in 42. So he's a POW in Japanese-held territory. And then you've got Fluff Ford, fantastic name. Fluff, she actually plotted the flight of her husband's plane as he headed to Midway. And he never came back, but she carried on working. And I think there's this general attitude that women are hysterical, that they're going to have a meltdown every 5 seconds because they can't emotionally handle being this close to war. And what these women demonstrate is that they absolutely can, and they can suffer horrendous personal loss and worry and fear for people that they love and carry on doing their job just as effectively. And I think that that's amazing.
That's really incredible. Was there any official recognition by the military or by the U.S. government of the ward and the help they provided and the lives they saved?
It's always tricky with these kind of secret organizations. You can't give that public recognition because you would reveal the existence of the system and the technology. And obviously, heading into the Cold War, straight off the back of the Second World War, we're keen to keep our secrets where defense is concerned. But what you do get is an internal recognition in the military of the incredible work this organization's done. So in 1945, Brigadier General Howard Davidson, he sends a letter to the chief supervisor of the ward. It's a lady called Catherine Coonley. And he writes, "I've seen many fighter controls, have several under me now, but the one in Honolulu, manned by the wards," I love that he says manned by the wards, who are all women, "is the best I have seen. You and your girls can take great pride in the fact that you've maintained the best air raid defense system in the world." So there is that recognition. Wow. There. It just unfortunately can't be super public. And I think that's another reason why we don't tend to know about them, which is a great shame.
We've been talking to King's College London lecturer and World War II historian Sarah Louise Miller. We'll return after a break to hear more about her upcoming book on Hawaii's Women at War.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Christy Nelson, author of Wake Up Grateful. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the transformative practice of taking nothing for granted.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Honolulu Waldorf School and Nohea Gallery.
Welcome back to our Notable Women in Hawaii History, Hana Ho Show. We're revisiting recent interviews with or about notable women in our history. Let's continue our conversation with Hawaii author and historian Sarah Louise Miller about the WARD, the Women's Air Raid Defense. She'll be on Oahu soon conducting research for a full book on women's roles in the war effort. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender earlier this month.
Let's turn now to the book you're working on. Put me in your shoes in, I guess, 2022, when this article finally comes out and you don't feel like you're done yet with this chapter of history.
I am not done. And I am now writing Hawaii's Women at War, which is an entire book. So the ward are not alone. There are women in the Coast Guard, the Marines, the Army, the Navy, the Red Cross, YMCAs, nurses. There are women all over the war effort in Hawaii, and they deserve a book of their own. They deserve a major project. So that is what I am currently working on. So the ward will have a chapter, of course they will. But I'm also very interested in this idea of women in Hawaii serving in a war effort on an island. They are at risk. It's the island with the most distance between another landmass in the world. There's nobody coming to help them if things go wrong. It's amazing to me how women were not content to just sit there and let men protect them. They got up and they wanted to get involved. And you actually have women coming from other islands, Samoa, Fiji, Tonga. They come to Hawaii to learn how to be nurses, for instance, because they anticipate casualties. So you've got women standing up in the Pacific and going, yeah, we're not going to take this laying down. We are going to fight back and do what we can to protect our homes and our islands. And there's a long history of that in Hawaii and in the Pacific. And when I was in Hawaii, I just fell in love with the islands, and I fell in love with the history of the islands and the people. And I thought, this needs to be done properly.
Yeah, that is such an interesting distinction of you have women coming from the mainland. Maybe their spouses are in some way connected to the war effort too, but you also have the local population, and as you're saying, in the rest of the Pacific, I'm sure also felt quite destabilized and threatened.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think it's really tempting to talk about the war in the Pacific and list these islands off as if they have, you know, no other importance than the island hopping campaign with General MacArthur. But we tend to forget that those islands are home to people who have lived there all along, and they didn't ask for this war. They are involved in it, whether they like it or not. And I think that it's time to kind of recognize what they went through and how they felt about it and what they did and why they did it. I think it's a very important piece of history that's been quite overlooked. And also how they carry on being women. So then nobody's asked them to stop being women. And there's this idea that if you put a woman in uniform, that sort of stripped her of her femininity, but they're not. There's these makeup parlours that are set up. Elizabeth Arden sets up all these sort of makeup parlours around the islands, and they can get their hair done. And I think there's something very striking about being a woman in a uniform. You are a female warrior. And that, again, you know, if you look at Hawaiian history, that's something quite powerful about that.
You're coming here to do some more research on that book, and you have a specific request. You're still looking for people.
I think there's a lot that you can find in archives, but there's a lot that you can't. And some of the best information that you can find is from people who were there or people who knew people that were there. So I am looking to hear from anybody that was there or anybody who had family stories passed down from women who were involved in the war effort in Hawaii. So I'm looking for, you know, stories. I'm looking for, what was your war like? What was your grandmother's war like? What was your mother's war like? Your auntie, whoever it is. I'm looking for those personal stories because I want these women's voices to jump out of the page. I don't want it to be a list of facts of what happened and who was involved. You need that kind of personal touch. And that was what was so special about those transcribed interviews for the ward. They said how they felt, what they saw, what their daily lives were like. And I am looking for people that might know that about their relatives or people that they knew. So I'd be very, very keen to hear from anybody who has that kind of story to tell.
And what dates are you here, and how, if people have stories, should they get in touch with you?
So I will be on Oahu from the 28th of March through to the 11th of April. I would be very happy to meet in person if that is amenable, but also I can be contacted by email.
I know we've kind of danced around the topic of why the ward and why women's efforts in Hawaii during World War II have been so overlooked, but if you wanted to address that head on.
I've spent my life devoting a lot of time to that question and to trying to do something about it. So I did my bachelor's, my master's and my PhD on women and war in various different ways. I now work as a lecturer at the British Military Academy, where I still work on women and war every single day. And I think that it's a story that hasn't finished. And I think, you know, with it being Women's History Month, I think it's really important to pay attention to that question. But also, it's not enough to just answer it and move on. We need to look at, you know, what women did in Hawaii and learn from it and recognize that that is a story that is not finished. It is carrying on. And I think, you know, one of the things I get asked a lot is what changed for women after their wartime service. A lot changed, but a lot didn't. It took time. But what they did do was set a precedent for women to then go on and do those things more and more and more. And now we have our basically equal military services. But that took time and it took effort. And it started here. And I think it's really important to recognize the legacy of these people, that it's so, so important, and to keep telling these stories in as wide a way as we possibly can. And, you know, thank you and good night is not enough. We have to carry on.
That was historian and author Sarah Louise Miller talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. Listeners who have a story to share with her can contact her by going to her website, sarah-louisemiller.com. America's Best Idea, that's been the unofficial slogan of our national park since the 2009 Ken Burns documentary brought the majestic landscapes directly into our homes. But this notion that the country's most beautiful places are preserved for everyone to enjoy overlooks a complicated history of imperialism, particularly of indigenous women. In order to bring this story to the forefront, the National Park Service teamed up with a group of researchers at the University of California at Davis. They combed through the archives to find the women at the center of National Park's history. Here's a rebroadcast of HBR's Savannah Harriman Pote's story about these women from April 2022.
In early 2020, the National Park Service set out to commemorate the 100-year anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which granted women suffrage in the United States. The park sent out a survey to see whether visitors wanted women's history to play a larger role at national sites. The results were a resounding yes.
People indicated that they wanted to know more about women's history, women's lives, women's politics in a more robust way.
That's University of California at Davis professor Lisa Matterson, who, along with fellow Davis historian Ellen Hartigan O'Connor, was tasked by the Park Service with bringing women back into the narrative of national parks. Hartigan O'Connor says the first step was challenging the notion that the 19th Amendment gave all women the right to vote.
It's popularly known as the Women's Rights Amendment, and it does remove sex as a bar to federal voting, but it left in place many other kinds of restrictions on many women's ability to vote. So women who are restricted by race, by relationship with men of particular ethnic and racial backgrounds. And it struck us as we were thinking about these Western and Pacific sites, which are sites of U.S. empire. And this has been an important move in history, is recognizing the United States as an imperial power in the West and in the Pacific. So that empire, too, has this expansive quality, expanding U.S. territory, again, often at the hands of or with the active participation of one group of women, white women in particular, at the expense of women of color and indigenous women. So that empire and the 19th Amendment had this double edge, that by focusing the stories of women, diverse groups of women, we could really explore that and kind of make a more thorough, full, and complex history of the United States at the same time.
One example of white women working against indigenous rights that Matterson and Hartigan O'Connor found involves none other than suffrage icon Susan B. Anthony. After the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1898, Anthony petitioned Congress to include more political rights for white women in Hawaii's territorial constitution, at the expense of Native Hawaiian and immigrant men. Anthony told senators, quote, "I think we are of as much importance as are the Filipinos, Puerto Ricans, Hawaiians, Cubans, and all the different sorts of men that you have before you. When you get those men, you have an ignorant and unlettered people who know nothing of our institutions."
For white women suffragists, empire, U.S. territorial expansion across the North American continent, overseas, to the Pacific, to the Caribbean, created moments after the end of Reconstruction to bring federal voting rights to Congress again, because there's conversations taking place about voting rights within these conquered territories, whether they would become a part of the United States, whether what would be the rights of conquered peoples, of colonial subjects. And so this created many opportunities for white women suffragists to talk about white women's rights and women's voting rights. And then if you look at the kind of other side, there were many women who did not want to be a part of the United States. And so when we think about the 19th Amendment, it's not just about becoming more deeply incorporated into the United States. There were indigenous women who resisted in becoming part of the United States. They didn't seek more political rights because they didn't want to be a part of the United States.
Hartigan O'Connor says that the national parks were one of the central stages where these political battles played out.
You know, national parks were created in the 19th century with an idea of kind of conservation and control. So ideas about preserving a so-called wilderness and bringing it under control of whites of the U.S. government. And one of the things that we sought to do in selecting women for this project, in selecting women's lives to explore for this project, were to challenge the idea that these parks are located on wilderness sites, right? That one of the things we really wanted to bring out is the use of these space and the creation of these landscapes by indigenous women whose homelands they are. So thinking about a park in Hawaii and thinking about, for instance, the Hawaiian royal family and women of Hawaiian royalty who spent the 18th and 19th century using these sites to consolidate their own power, to kind of maneuver within dynastic politics, shore up alliances, often against the United States, but in other times, you know, kind of leveraging the United States or Britain or other empires kind of against their own internal politics. So really reminding everyone and reasserting that these are places with long histories and the very land itself is shaped by these women, these people who lived and worked, and the land had deep meaning to them.
In addition to crafting an overall narrative of women's history, Matterson and Hargan O'Connor assembled a team of researchers to assemble short biographies of specific women who influenced the parks. Ellie Kaplan, a PhD student at Davis, focused on Geraldine Kanui Bell, the first Native Hawaiian woman to serve as a superintendent for the National Park Service. Bell oversaw the parks at Pu'uhonua o Honaunau and Koloko Honokahau on Hawaii Island. Kaplan says one of Bell's most important contributions was the repatriation of iwi kupuna, or ancestral bones, that the National Park Service had in their records.
The fact that the National Park Service had these ancestral bones really speaks to this history of conquest, this history of empire that the National Park Service is tied up in. And then seeing Jerry Bell take leadership of these sites and having one of her earliest acts as superintendent be the repatriation, working with community members, working with the Hawaiian Burial Council in order to return these remains to descendants, to their communities in a really culturally appropriate manner, speaks to the way that Native Hawaiian women particularly took ownership and took control of these sites.
The research team also included the story of Olivia Robello Bretha, a Hansen's disease patient who spent almost 7 decades at Kalaupapa on Molokai. In that time, Bretha combated stigmatism against Hansen's patients while building a community in exile.
So here was a site where people were meant to be forgotten, and instead they built their own community. They had relationships with each other. They had active religious and social lives, economic lives. And having that then become a site within the National Park Service in the 1980s provided a continued place of community for people who had been confined there. So Bretha has this quote where she talks about, right, this place that was once a prison has now become a paradise. So thinking about this repurposing of sites to become places of empowerment.
The research team at UC Davis crafted over 60 biographies of women who shaped the course of national parks in the West and Pacific. Hardigan O'Connor thinks that this project has captured the public's attention in part because they can connect with the women at the center of it.
You know, this was one of the only projects I've worked on that I have a prayer of my mother being interested. I mean, she's interested. She's my mother. She's interested in all of these things. But, you know, I showed her this and she said, oh, I'm working my way through the biographies. And she, you know, she could immediately relate to the personal stories.
But Matterson says that these women shouldn't have had to wait 100 years to have their stories told. And to create a better picture of women's history, we should start with the women in our own lives.
We do sincerely hope that this is a source of also inspiration. I mean, for people to turn to their family, to turn to their mothers, their grandmothers, their kin, and to do oral history interviews and ask about their lives and to document those lives.
And for Hargan O'Connor, the message of this project boils down to one key idea.
Women as protagonists in history, essentially, and women as protagonists who have as much multiplicity and complexity as male protagonists in history.
That was University of California Davis historians Ellen Hardigan O'Connor and Lisa Matterson, along with PhD student Ellie Kaplan. They were speaking with The Conversation Savannah Harriman Pote about their autobiographical series on women in our national park system. That is it for this Aloha Friday. Call or talk back line and leave us your comments. That's 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, along with help from Maddie Bender and Savannah Harriman Pope. The Becker quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music was courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.